From Given, this is Purposing, the podcast that lifts the lid on how to run a truly purpose-driven business. I'm Becky Willen, and with the help of leaders at some of the world's most recognized brands, I'll be demystifying this often misunderstood topic into clear, actionable advice you can use in your own business. This week, I'm joined by Gemma Wiggs and Jamie McEwen from World Rugby, the global governing body for rugby union and organisers of the Rugby World Cup. Gemma is head of tournament, team and rugby services, and is currently leading preparations for the Women's Rugby World Cup, England 2025. Jamie is World Rugby Sustainability, Diversity and Inclusion Manager, championing the power of sport to drive meaningful social and environmental impact. In this conversation, you'll hear how they're making rugby more accessible and inclusive, and why this is an essential driver of growth for the game. What they're doing to create positive impact long after the tournament ends, and their top advice when using any kind of big moment to drive positive change that lasts. But before all that, let's hear about their journeys to discovering the true transformative power of sport.
I was a hockey, a cricket player, and then at Loughborough Uni took up rugby. My dad, a massive rugby fan, and he was very chuffed when his daughter took up rugby.
Gemma had always been sports mad, and it was clear from early in her career that she had a desire to use sport as a tool for positive change. Working in volleyball at the London Olympics, she had to figure out a real sustainability challenge.
We didn't have the budgets to bring in additional resource, so I've led on the project to use the sand that we'd procured across the 11 courts in Horse Guards Parade and the training venue. That sand was then distributed across the country, and we had permanent beach volleyball courts, not just in the beaches that you would see, but in inner city.
Unaware that this was just the start of using the power of sport for good, Gemma later became director of the Canoe SLA World Championships. It was here that she truly understood how much influence a leader in the sports events industry had on the local community.
Actually realising that opportunity of bringing people into the event to have that positive influence and that create that positive change was so much more impactful. So we had a real focus on the local community, but also a really strong sustainability campaign, given, you know, the blue space and the blue waters, how much that impacted the sport.
My dad set up a third world NGO, a non-governmental agency for development in the 1970s called Trocra, which is still in existence today. My mother, she taught in a local school for disadvantaged children and teens from the Irish travelling community. So, you know, that probably inspired me to have a greater understanding and awareness of all those, you know, near and far, you know, the haves, the have-nots.
Jamie's family had inspired him to take an early interest in sustainable development and social justice. After spending time working in the Australian government, he joined an event agency, allowing him to travel the world and finding himself in Ong Village up in the mountains in Laos.
I'd packed, you know, we were travelling light. I had a small corporate branded frisbee in my rucksack. You know, there's no electricity, but we got out the frisbee and we started playing with the kids. And bit by bit, I mean, the whole village seemed to join us, and we played frisbee for, you know, about 3 hours until it was time for everyone to get to bed. And just seeing the smiles, the laughter, and that was just simple sport, throwing a frisbee around. That's how we were able to communicate. So that was a real eye-opening moment for me.
Jamie moved back to Ireland in 2008 and joined the International Rugby Board, now World Rugby, to support the campaign for rugby's re-inclusion in the Olympics.
It was a couple of years after as well that I remember one of their team telling a story about this Hmong village. When Child Fund Rugby arrived with a rugby ball, the boys took one look at it and said, "It's not round, it mustn't be for us," and went off to play something else. The girls said, "Well, if the boys aren't playing it, then it must be for us." So the girls took the rugby ball and, you know, proceeded to run around. And it just, you know, reminded me of that moment and that transformational power of sport. Yeah, that's kind of brought me to where I am in terms of the sustainability journey.
How could I play my role in what I knew could be the most impactful and biggest Rugby World Cup that has ever existed on home soil? I mean, who couldn't stick their hand up for that one?
So, Gemma and Jamie, welcome to the show. Gemma, hopefully most people will know that the Women's Rugby World Cup is being hosted here in England later this year. What's your ambition for the tournament?
I think for Rugby World Cup 2025, it's all about showcasing women's rugby and women's sport as a whole. It's using the event as a platform to not only go women's rugby, though, but rugby in general, both within the UK and globally. We've got, in essence, five key principles that we're working to within delivering the World Cup, which we really had a clear statement of intent when we set out to run the tournament. So one of those being enhancing the profile of women's rugby through the quality of the product to global audiences. We've got a great partnership with the BBC, which will not only provide a platform for the sport on the field of play, but some really exciting initiatives and projects to see the personality of the sport, which we think is really important. Sitting alongside that, we want to create exceptional value and driving revenues to fuel the future growth of women's rugby. Rugby World Cup 25 is really a stepping stone as part of World Rugby's wider strategy. So the next two World Cups are already being awarded to Australia in 29 and the USA in 2033. So how can we create revenue from the tickets that we've sold, the amazing commercial partnerships we got, to make sure that the product becomes sustainable moving forwards? And then moving in, I suppose, from a more domestic essence is bringing in new audiences. So how do we create those long-term fans of a sport through great, exceptional fan experiences within the eight venues that we've got? And within an area of work which the team I lead has a key focus on is that enhancing the tournament experience for the teams and match officials. So there's a significant amount of investment going into that performance environment for the players, supporting that team management and the match officials so that they can really excel on the field of play. And that's not, in essence, only just at tournament time, but World Rugby have got a number of programs and initiatives supporting those participating unions in the longer term, not only just leading up into the tournament, but setting those sustainable foundations moving forwards. And I think finally, that the fifth one within there, and probably most important of all, is that empowering real change. And that's where our purpose-led programs come into. We really want to inspire and ignite meaningful change within the communities. So I think as a tournament, we want to be a platform to champion women's and girls through the initiatives delivered both by World Rugby, both through the RFU Impact 25 program and the initiatives that we're delivering as a tournament, as a local operating company ourselves. So I think from that one, you can see a whole host of exciting aspirations, which we know will not only be a generational moment for women's rugby, but rugby and women's sport as a whole.
Brilliant. And I love that idea of creating a generational moment. Can you bring to life a little bit about what that really looks like in practice?
Yeah, I think as World Rugby as an international federation is very much looking at what the long-term strategy is for the sport. And women's rugby is actually that catalyst for growth across the globe. So you look at the USA, for example, and you look at the Ilona Meyer effect within the USA and within women's sport. So how can we harness the personalities of our sport to create greater dialogue, to create a focus on women's sport, an investment on women's rugby that not only just sees the growth of women's rugby, but brings actually a lot more external audiences, investment to the sport as a whole. So using 2025 as that catalyst for change, not just for the women's program, but I suppose the sport as a whole.
Jamie, coming to you, how does the ambition for the Women's Rugby World Cup fit within World Rugby's purpose more broadly?
Yeah, look, pleased to say as the clock ticks down to the opening match, it fits perfectly with the World Rugby purpose. I mean, our strategic plan, which actually comes to a close at the end of this year, runs from 2021 to 2025, you know, states that World Rugby's purpose is growing rugby by making it more relevant and accessible. And Gemma touched on that there. I mean, being accessible to participants, spectators and audiences, you know, it means that player welfare concerns are addressed to make the sport ever safer, ensuring the sport is open and inclusive, that high quality, appealing, engaging content is readily available to fans new and old, and that unions have the appropriate capability and capacity. Being relevant, I mean, it means it's ensuring that the sport is attractive, that people are aware of it. You know, there's great excitement building around the tournament now, and that's building on the back of previous tournaments and the Paris Olympics recently as well, where Gemma was mentioning about Ilona Meyer and that Olympic effect, the halo effect, the growth of the sport into traditional but new markets as well. And, you know, with that, you know, it needs to chime with 21st century lifestyles, behaviours and values. So with the tournament coming up now, the growing the game, making it that bit more relevant and accessible. You know, we're moving from 12 teams to 16 teams from the previous edition in New Zealand in 22, which itself was delayed due to our old friend coronavirus. But we've moved from 3 to 8 venues. So that makes it more accessible across the country, which in itself will have benefits for so the environmental footprint as well. But bringing rugby into more communities across the country, record ticket sales and engagements on social media, all of these are showing that, you know, women's rugby, it is this generational moment, and the tournament itself would perfectly support that purpose.
And so, Gemma, I think one of the really fascinating things about this is that Women's Rugby World Cup 2025 obviously won't exist as an organisation after this year. And yet you've got this ambition to create, you know, generational moment and lasting change. So, you know, how are you doing that? What are you doing to hardwire that idea of championing women and girls into how you design and deliver the tournament so that you're actually driving lasting change?
For me, the only way to ensure true legacy of the tournament is through a partnership approach and establishing these programs early on. You know, not just waiting for the tournament to happen and harness the interest off the back of it. So prior to confirmation of England hosting the tournament, the RFU and UK Sport were having early conversations about how we can use the tournament as a platform for social impact. The RFU Impact 25 program is actually in its third year with programs investing in participation, facilities at local rugby clubs, supporting women and girls in coaching and officiating. And this is complemented by the wider World Rugby Impact Beyond 25 program, which has got programs more globally to support the long-term growth and develop of the women's game. So these two programs run by partnership organizations really sits alongside the work that we're doing as an LOC. Within the LOC itself, though, we're proud of the fact that we're driving lasting change around through the embedding of it within our strategy. So the organization values right from the start, and that culture that we built from the early stages was really important. And we were really clear with a statement of intent that we made. So through building it into policy, it forms part of your decision-making process at every level. We've got procurement policies whereby the women and girls support and that social impact piece is built in within our procurement policies. So any contractor or organization that we're partnering on for the delivery of that, we're seeking partnership so that there is that ongoing deliverable within the wider industry. For me, one of the pieces we're really proud of is around providing opportunities for women through the tournament. So whether that be through our recruitment and appointment strategy to ensure female appointments within the match officials program, the match commissioners, our ball teams, our team liaison officers, or working with our security partners to make sure that we've got a minimum 50% of team security advisors in what essence is a real male-dominated industry. And we've recently launched our commentators, presenters, content creators program, which is specifically aligned to maximizing female representation within that industry. So for me, I really see that the tournament as a launch pad for opportunity. So how can we create the future leaders of tomorrow? How can we create that opportunity for women and girls to come into the industry, but also use the tournament and the policies and the strategy and our statement of intent to take other people on this journey? So we're not just a one-hit wonder of a tournament, but actually we're influencing that wider network and that wider industry as a whole.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. And I guess, well, rugby has a role to play, Jamie, in terms of making sure that future tournaments can build on all of the lessons that are being learned and the kind of change that's beginning. So can you talk a little bit about what's practically involved in making sure that that really does happen?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you probably need a slightly longer podcast to cover all those aspects. But look, three key elements to me, you know, would be around, and then Gemma alluded to this earlier, having a clear and agreed vision and governance around the tournament's ambition and legacy, early engagement with the key stakeholders, you know, so that they're, you know, that'll nothing about us without us, and making sure they're identified and engaged early on. And then what's critical as well, for as we move from tournament to tournament, and our new operating delivery model helps facilitate this, is that stronger transfer of knowledge processes with continual improvement. Building legacy, it's very much a team effort. It has to deliver for all the key stakeholders while attempting to raise the bar each time. I mean, sometimes there'll be conflicting priorities and objectives. So it's about identifying those and trying to build that consensus. if it's done right, the benefits of the tournament, you know, can be felt well in advance of that opening match, you know, whether that's through community engagement initiatives, building awareness and excitement, opportunities to try out rugby, or sessions with coaches and future leaders to help develop them, for example. Just as in tournament planning and delivery, there's a complex network of stakeholders. Gemma mentioned some as well already, you know, from the teams and the fans that make the tournament what it is, to the host cities, the host communities and venues, and government partners, commercial partners, host unions, and World Rugby ourselves. It's also important to look at the legacy objectives, both on and off the pitch. We talk about rugby development, you know, where we're looking at increases in the number of players, teams, match officials, clubs, events, etc. But rugby for development is also a key element of any legacy programme. You know, looking at ways to use that power of sport, its values, its influence and its appeal to benefit not just the economies, but also the communities and the environment too.
And I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I guess those legacy objectives are all about positive impacts. You know, those aren't immediate. That's all about long-term change. So I think it's interesting to me how you set about to sort of measure and evaluate the long-term impact of the work that you're doing now, Gemma, when I guess the organization won't formally exist. So can you talk a little bit about the structures and mechanisms, I guess, you're putting in place to make sure that you can measure the impact of the work that you're doing now beyond the tournament?
I think there's two elements to this one. And one is where as an LOC, as a Rugby World Cup 25 entity that come the 27th of September, the tournament will, you know, have the final and we down tools to a certain extent and you know, the team will disband onto future opportunities. So for me, there's the bit that we can control within the LOC and the measurables within that is actually the impact that we can have on the bits we can control within the tournament. And I mentioned before, you know, that training piece that we can do with our staff around EDI and opportunities, that bit that we can control around the influence we can have on the contractors and organizations we're bringing on board. So we've got KPIs measuring the number of sustainability initiatives that we will partner with the venues around, knowing that those partnerships that we're doing with the venues will have a long-term impact. We've got the number of local women-led businesses that we can work with so that we can create a platform and an opportunity for them. So there's the one element of it that we know through the KPIs we can bring into the tournament, we know have a long-term impact through that opportunity piece. But actually, for me, the long-term measurable one is around that partnership approach, which I mentioned before, around the World Rugby and the RFU impact programs. And what we've done as a collective is come together with some statements of success. So the RFU have been really bold in some of their statements around the KPIs. They're looking to, you know, 100,000 participants by 2027. How can actually we use the tournament and our collective approach to really influence those statements that the RFU are seeking to achieve? But we've all got a role to play within that. And, you know, our comm strategy or our strategic approach to free-to-air TV very much fundamentally has an impact on those wider programs that World Rugby and the RFU are putting in place. So each individual organization has got our own KPIs within which we'll be measured on, but there very much is that collaboration piece and understanding that how that we can influence and play our part within the jigsaw puzzle of what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So I guess it's almost, you've got this sort of how you drive impact directly through the decisions that you're making about how you design and deliver the tournament, but then also, you know, how you create impact through the influence that you have as part of a much kind of wider group of organizations who are working towards the same goals. And I think that really touches on something interesting about the power of sport to create change in much bigger ways beyond those sort of direct impacts. Jamie, I guess looking beyond the tournament or even rugby more generally, what are the things that I guess we can learn about how sport uses the power of culture and community to bring about change across, you know, really huge topics, you know, inclusion, social impact, sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a good example. You know, we're talking there, you know, the Rugby World Cup and an international tournament, bringing it back down to the local level. My own local club, Seapoint Rugby in Dublin, they have a mixed ability rugby team called the Seapoint Dragons, and it's made up of guys and girls, you know, different ages, different intellectual and physical abilities. And lots of clubs have seen the impact of climate change, where, you know, increasingly pitches are being flooded and unplayable, and, you know, practice has to be cancelled. And, you know, for the Sea Point Dragons, there was a very wet period. And I know Ireland isn't entirely unfamiliar with wet periods, but, you know, everyone is really seeing this. And the pitches were flooded. And what happened there is that the Sea Point Dragons couldn't come down. The first team were due to be playing a match. The Sea Point Dragons were going to be supporting them. That could have been one of their few social outings during the week, you know, that sort of safe space where they get to meet other friends and play and cheer on a sport that they love. So there's an environmental impact that is having a social impact on the inclusion within the community. And then there's an economic impact where if matches aren't being played, the clubhouse is closed, revenues are down, and they can't sell, you know, teas and coffees and buns and everything else. So it just shows how, you know, the economic, the social, and the environmental legs of the sustainability stool need to be balanced for a more even outcome. Look, more broadly, sport for development, sport with purpose, it's definitely come a long way in a relatively short time. You know, that's helped in part by the common bonds and values like discipline, respect, integrity, passion and solidarity that we value at World Rugby. And those values that attract us to sport in the first place. And increased awareness in many cases has brought about an increased sense of responsibility or duty ever since Nelson Mandela famously talked about how sport has the power to change the world. It does have the power to change the world. And, you know, we can see that with the efforts of sport to align with and contribute to the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals. But it doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen by itself. And like so many other aspects of life, sport is also increasingly at risk, unfortunately, of being exploited or weaponized, seems to be the word of the day, and used to promote personal or political self-interest. So that creates challenges across a number of areas. So look, there need to be effective guardrails in place to safeguard the safe, fair, inclusive practice and enjoyment of sport for all. And it can be a real challenge to find consensus on occasion. Things aren't always as clear cut as others may have you believe. But I mean, for me personally, I firmly believe in rugby's vision as a global sport for all, true to its values. And I think our role here and the role of other sport practitioners, governing bodies, clubs, players, fans, you know, is to realize that vision, that it is a sport for all, you know, continually identify and address any barriers or obstacles, whether they're real or perceived, so that people can actively and meaningfully participate, whatever your background, you know, whether that's taking part on or off the pitch or involved in other ways, be it in the dressing room, the boardroom, the classroom, or even watching from the living room. So look, that for me will help bring it back to World Rugby's purpose, growing rugby by making it more relevant and accessible, and help make our sport more sustainable, more resilient into the future.
Yeah. And this is very much about, I guess, the business of sport. And I think perhaps in the past, I guess a focus on championing women and girls would have been seen as CSR or philanthropic or a nice to have. Gemma, you've touched on the extent to which purpose and inclusion can really support the growth and long-term commercial success of sports like rugby. So could you unpack that a little bit more? And perhaps if there are any sort of anecdotes that help reinforce that would be really useful.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting how far women's sport has come. You know, we've still got a really long way to go, but I think it's an interesting question because women's sport actually is no longer just a values-driven play. It's delivering real business returns. And while value alignment and meaningful impact remain important, the next phase moving forwards of growth demands much more. But I think that's not to say that purpose and inclusion aren't important. They 100% are. You know, where two organizations can align on purpose and values, the benefits of that partnership are so much more, that synergy effect. And the value of a true partnership approach brings so much more to the commercial investment for those organizations. And I think where we've seen true alignment in purpose and inclusion for us is the relationship that World Rugby have with Gallagher. So they're a tournament sponsor, but the relationship and the partnership is so much more than that. You know, we have the financial benefits of that commercial investment. There is the return on investment for Gallagher themselves through the brand exposure piece, but but there's so much more going into that relationship. And that's where that alignment of purpose and inclusion is really showcased within this one. So through their partnership with the tournament, World Rugby have invested in a high performance academy, which is a fully immersive development and leadership program. And it's benefiting both organizations from one, that initial alignment and purpose and inclusion to bring the two organizations together. You're seeing the commercial returns and investment for Gallagher as an organization, the commercial investment that you see for the tournament, but actually the wider impact we can have through that relationship is really important. And it's about scaling visibility, it's about building commercial confidence and translating momentum into what in essence hopefully is measurable outcomes.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about how strategic these partnerships have become, because I think generally in kind of sports marketing in the past, partnerships have been, I guess, quite superficial, just more about exchange of logos, you know, visibility, kind of eyeballs, whereas actually partnerships that are designed to meet shared goals based on shared values seems like a recipe for a much more kind of successful, impactful relationship.
You alluded there to the transactional nature previously, where it was just here's the check and here's your branding on the perimeter boards. That's not good enough for organizations anymore, and it's not good enough for sports organizations. And our commercial team will be coming to us saying, you know, you can start to see this trend coming over the last number of years where they want to know not just a tick box, do you have this or do you have that, but they want to get under the skin of what your sustainability initiatives are. Do you have particular priority areas, how you're focusing it? And then again, that point of CSR being an add-on previously, which could then be dropped if times got tight and budgets were challenging. But actually, you know, seeing the value that it can bring through these commercial partnerships, through funding opportunities, through linking into to government partners, sports ministries, National Olympic committees, where you can say, you know, we have a program, our sport identifies with this, our communities buy into it, and it's delivering real and meaningful change. And when those programs are done right, they not just save money through efficiencies, but they attract investment.
And I think some of this is consumer driven as well. You know, as consumers of brands and of products, we're expecting a lot more of the companies we're buying our products for. So, you know, as we as individuals buying those products can hold those organizations to account for their purpose, for their inclusion, for their impact, then we can actually all have power at all ends of the market.
So if we were to fast forward a decade, so we're in the USA for the 2033 Women's World Cup. What would you love to see in terms of positive impact? Paint a picture of what the kind of possibilities are.
For me, you know, for World Rugby and for the sport, we want more fans watching more teams, playing more competitive matches and with new names on the trophy. I think secondly, you know, I'd love to see is that the rising tide of women's and girls rugby is helping lift all rugby boats, you know, in the US and beyond as well. And lastly, to see that the women stars of this decade becoming the coaches, commentators and leaders of the next.
And I think for me, it's wholly aligned with that one. And you see the growth of women's sport and women's rugby in England and the UK, and it's been exponential, building off the back of the success of women's Euros and the women's cricket T20 prior to that. I would love to see this globally. And I think you look at the audiences and the exponential ticket sales that we've seen within 2025 World Cup, and you've got the England-Wales match at Principality Stadium this weekend, and Wales have sold over 18,000 tickets, you know, which is unprecedented. I think for me, how can we make this global? How can we make this normal practice for large fan bases, not just at that national team level, but actually at club level? And then in itself, all of that positively impacting the game at grassroots level through the involvement in women at all roles. So we're not just seeing, you know, our women and girls, you know, passion project being around the participation piece, but actually women and girls given opportunity throughout the spectrum of the sport globally.
So I guess sort of taking a step back from sport, the topic of this conversation was all about, you know, how do you use a sort of a big moment like a Rugby World Cup to drive lasting change. So if you bring it all together, Gemma, I'll come to you first. What's your number one piece of advice for leaders who want to use a big moment of any description to drive lasting positive change?
I think for me, there's two pieces to this one. One is be bold. But agree it early on. Agree your strategy early and get early engagement from partners so that you can maximize not only the short-term impact of your big moment, but that long-term impact. Create it as the event or the big moment as a platform for longer-term change. But you can't do that if you don't bring people, as cheesy as it sounds, if you don't bring people on the journey. But for me, it's be bold and build it early and get people on board.
Jamie?
I would say be prepared for other big moments, whether they might be positive or negative ones. We don't always know what's around the corner. You could ask the Tokyo 2020 Olympic team and Paralympic team about that. Look, I think, you know, the influence and reach of Ilona Marr, as we talked about, Antoine Dupont at the Paris 24 Olympics, you know, were really big moments. They helped slingshot the sport into the hearts and minds of new fans and audiences while the world was watching. But other times, a big moment isn't always what you thought it might have been. Rugby World Cup 2019, that was certainly a big moment for our sport. It was the first time the tournament was held in Asia. You know, really great Impact Beyond and legacy programs there. And then along came Typhoon Hagibis during the pool stages, you know, one of the largest, latest typhoons to hit Japan in well over a generation. So, you know, it may have impacted tournament operations and match schedules, but, you know, that's small fry compared to that bigger picture, which was, you know, the havoc that it wreaked in Japan. And, you know, the clear message that our sport was not immune to the impacts of climate change as well. So that was a real big moment, but it was also one that turning a negative into a positive, or, you know, a challenge into an opportunity. It was one which helped reinforce the need for positive and lasting change around climate action in our sport. It let us, you know, COVID kicked off a year later, and yeah, we had that opportunity then to develop and publish our environmental sustainability plan in January 2022. So that really helped embed sustainability into our day-to-day activities and tournament event planning around, you know, delivery, dissolution, and legacy. So being able to, you know, sort of planning to fail, failing to plan, but just be mindful that big moments might not always be what you thought they were going to be.
Yeah, I love that. Be prepared for the big moments you're not expecting. Thank you both for being such brilliant guests on Purposing. Thanks again to Gemma and Jamie. Loads of brilliant ideas there. So here are a few things I've taken from the conversation if you want big moments to drive lasting change. Design in your purpose to every decision. Don't just wait for the big moment to happen and expect to harness the interest off the back of it. Procurement and recruitment are two areas where Women's Rugby World Cup are hardwiring purpose into decision-making, and the tournament is becoming a launchpad for opportunity for women and girls as a result. Engage stakeholders and partners early in the process. Impact can't wait until the final whistle. This means build partnerships, share knowledge and learnings as you go, to influence the wider system that you're part of. But also be agile. Be prepared for the moments you're not expecting or can't plan for, whether that's the opportunity presented by people or topics suddenly becoming incredibly popular, or the challenge presented by unforeseen events that can be made a platform for action. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you'd like more practical advice on building a purpose-driven business with brilliant insights from people like Gemma and Jamie, download the Insider's Guide to Purpose at givenagency.com/thinking.